Welcome to Obuleti Oromo Women's Network monthly webinar and podcast. Our conversations are based on topics and issues that are prevalent in the Oromo community, especially pertaining to women. The podcasts are based on recorded monthly webinars led by leaders in our community. These podcasts are meant to attend to the education component of Obuleti's mission. If you're interested in learning more, please contact us via our website, email, and or social media networks. Webinar resources can be found on our website at obuleti.org/webinars. Hello everyone, welcome to Obuleti's monthly webinar. In this segment, we are hosting Kadra Muhammad, who is a police officer in Minnesota. She will be discussing her experiences as a police officer, her journey to become a police officer, as well as issues that she notices to be most prevalent in the Oromo community, as well as the larger African and African community. Kadra will also touch on ways that women can protect themselves from perpetrators of domestic violence and abuse, as well as ways that we can stay vigilant to prevent ourselves from being harmed. The presentation today will be an open dialogue, which means that people may ask questions throughout Kadra's presentation. With that being said, we will start off the conversation with introductions, and then Kadra will go ahead and start with her presentation.
My name, like you said, is Kadra Muhammad. I'm from St. Paul, Minnesota. And originally, I'm Oromo. My dad is from Oromia, but I grew up in Minnesota, so I don't really speak Oromo. I spent my whole life in St. Paul. I went to high school here and I did college in St. Cloud State. Got my 4-year degree from there before I became a police officer. So that's what I do now for the past 4 years as a sworn police officer.
Hi, I'm Arfase. I live in Minneapolis. I'm on the Obuleti board.
Hi, everyone. My name is Howie. I am one of the directors for Obuleti. I currently live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, going to school for counseling psychology, but I grew up in Portland, Oregon, but originally born in Oromia.
And then my name is Jelani. I'm also on staff with Obuleti. I currently live in Portland, Oregon. Just a little bit about me.
So like I said earlier, I went to St. Cloud State. I did my 4 years in criminal justice with a minor in human relations. And people always ask me how I got into policing, and that wasn't my intention while I was at St. Cloud. I wanted to go to law school. But I realized quickly the books and being stuck indoors in front of computers and writing all the time didn't fit my personality. So I did a ride along one day with a Minneapolis cop who is my mentor now, and he just kind of got me hooked into the job. It kind of went with the law degree that I was intending to get anyway. So I just continued my 4 years in criminal justice that way. And right out of school, I was lucky enough to get a student position at St. Paul Police Department. And they call that a community liaison officer. So you're basically playing the bridge between the police department and the community while you're still in school. And you kind of get your feet wet within the department and decide if this is really the kind of job you want to do. So I spent 1 year at St. Paul Police Department until I graduated, and I took the state exam to get my license to be able to be a police officer in Minnesota. After that, I got hired with Metro Transit, which is where I work at now. And 4 years later, I'm in our street crimes unit, and I'm, a mentor to about 15 girls at Humboldt High School, which is a high school in St. Paul. And as you guys know, I try to be active on social media to try to encourage other girls to join the police department, because it's a rough system for anyone, but of course it's not designed for minorities, so it's even harder. And to have someone that you can ask questions to, or even just lean on and look for guidance and support, is, I think, is very important. And although I didn't have that specific person that I could, that I looked like in the department for me to lean on, but I did have these amazing brothers that I have now, and they're in the police department, and they've already gone through a lot of the things that I had to go through. So my goal moving forward is to be that role model for other women. Some of the things that I had to go through to become a police officer, because it's not as easy as people think. You just go to school and you join the academy. It's a lot more rigorous than that. There's more hoops that you have to jump through. Right out of college, you have your degree. In Minnesota, we hold police officers to a higher standard than other states, where you need at least an associate's degree. In other states, you can be right out of high school. It's the same case in Michigan, but in Minnesota, you need your 2 year, and I got my 4 year. After that, you have to go through kind of like a separate police schooling, and that takes about another year. So you have a semester of learning the law, state statutes, procedural justice, which means like different constitutional rights and things like that. You need to know that to not violate, or so you'd be able to do the job effectively. And then the next semester is going to be more hands-on. So the tactical stuff, ground fighting, I guess is the simplest way for me to put it. Of course, you learn how to use a gun and taser and pepper spray and all of that, and handcuffing. And that's where the physical portion comes in after the second semester. So that's a whole year that you have to go through tests and continue with different trainings. And then after you pass all of those tests, then you go to the state exam, and you still have to pass that in order to get a license. And even after that, your license isn't activated until you join a police department. So I guess my initial step to go through all that, my initial step when it comes to mentoring is to show those students, law enforcement students, really all that they have to go through before they can even call themselves an official police officer. So yeah, that's just a little bit about the process and how I started and how I am trying to encourage others to join, I guess.
I know, Padra, you spoke about some hardships being like the only woman of color. Could you say more about that?
Yeah, sure. I guess the first hardship, first off, before when I got into this position, I didn't expect it to be such a big deal. I just thought I'm gonna be a police officer. I didn't really see what the big hype was about that, because I wanted to wear a hijab. Women of color, or just people of color in general, is scarce in policing. It's a white male dominant position. So I wasn't really, to be honest, mentally prepared for all of the scrutiny I would get trying to join the police department. So the first thing I encountered was when I finished my 4 year and I started the skills program, which is the police schooling. I was, to be just kind of blunt, I was verbally, I don't want to say verbally assaulted, but you know, some mean things were definitely said out in the open by professors who are supposed to be teaching us impartially on what we're supposed to be doing on this job. I was singled out, and like, it was a lot of pressure. You have a lot of eyes on you. You have specific instructors who even who specifically discouraged me and said, it's good that you're trying to do this, but you're not going to get too far. So before you spend all of your money on this schooling and training, you might want to take a step back and think about it. You know, just kind of discouraging things like that. I've been called out of my name, like a curse word. So it was a long, tough process. And without the support that I had from my male counterparts, that are African also, I wouldn't have been able to, I don't think I would have been able to finish as strongly as I did. So I did have a lot of support in that way. And I had professors or instructors also who encouraged me to work hard even outside of my studies, to, let's say, go to the gun range extra hours more than my classmates, because I've never held a gun before. I've never had to, just to get that extra practice, and I can be ahead of the class or even play catch up, because a lot of these white males that I'm in the class with have used guns in, during hunting season, or they know some of these statutes that I never had to learn before because they have family members who have kind of shown them that way. So there, it was, I was playing a lot of catch up a lot of the time. And like I said, because I had all eyes on me and I was like a target, even in social media, before I started getting on social media, it was difficult for sure. But like, I don't want to, like, it's going to sound a little cliche, but if I wasn't a person that was close to faith, and I didn't pray and I didn't believe that this was meant for me, I probably would have broke down. So like I said, I'm on my street crimes unit, and we go out and we target our high crime areas on the transit system. So that means high drug activity, high gang activity. And if we're working with other departments from agencies who don't know me personally, they expect me to need their help, or they don't expect me to know what I'm doing. So I continuously still have to prove myself that I'm just as equal as you are, and I got this job because I worked for it, not because I'm simply a minority. So yeah, those are some of the, I guess, general hardships.
I have a question for you, Hadra.
Sure.
How do you fight, especially amongst the communities of color, police officers kind of have a negative image, right? Almost they're feared because of all that we see on the news. Not that necessarily there's more happening, maybe because of access to social media or availability. We see all the shootings that are happening. How do you try and counteract that narrative? You know, I'm sure not all police officers are bad, but how does that affect you, and how do you try and create that comfort level from the community so they don't fear the police department? Even when they need it, and some people are scared to even call the police when they need it themselves.
Yeah, of course. That's a really good question. I'm glad that you asked that, because I was going to touch on that. But, you know, that is, it's really tough to try to counteract that. Because we have, like you said, access to social media, it makes telling a story so much easier, and it's easier to place blame either which way. The mentorship program that me and some of the other African brothers are in, Oroma and Somali, I think is, for us, is the best way that we can reach out to our community and be able to bridge that gap between the two. It, like you said, not all but police officers are bad, and it doesn't matter their race or what they are, but our job is difficult, and the line between doing the right thing, sometimes we have a lot of discretion, and the job is not black and white. There's a lot of different gray areas, and we can, I mean, even us as, like, even us as Africans, you stop somebody and they're like, oh, you're just another African girl, can't you let me off, like, I'm your people. And then, you know what I mean? So there are a lot of different lines where we have to be able to say, this is my job and this is what I have to do. This is what my job, and these are some things that I can let you get away with, but I can't let you get away with X, Y, and Z. Our mentor program that we do is not only through high school, but even younger, trying to get involved in community events and having conversations with the community one-on-one without having some kind of agenda behind it is really important, because if they can see you as a human and that this job simply is just a job for me, is really important, and it makes people more comfortable to be able to approach you if you can have those honest conversations. But it's not hard. And I encourage other people not to join, number one, because if we want to change that narrative, the only way we can do that is from the inside. You can't stand out from the outside and continuously to point fingers if people on the inside don't understand the community. You have to have people on the inside to be able to change those narratives and say, you need to understand where the community is hurting and where they're coming from. And a white male, he can live in Africa his whole life, would still never understand the way an African male would feel. So it's really important for us as minorities to get in these places of, in these positions like police officers and law and in any field, to be honest, just so we can have our point of view expressed from those angles. So it's really important, and to be able to have an open dialogue both ways, not only from our side, but from the community too. We should be able to reach out to each other and say, hey, we're having a barbecue, come through, or this is police week and we want the community to be involved in appreciating us, because our job isn't easy and we need the community's help to do our job. So yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I don't know if that answered it, so hopefully I touched on.
You did. Yeah. But I'm glad that you said that, you know, it takes both sides, right? Because I don't know how the Oromo community has approached the police department, but it does. We do have to be proactive for the whole community, right? To be, we can't just wait for the police department to come to us. And I think feeling comfortable and having more representatives, like you're saying, maybe more people of color in the force, than even, let's say, if there is a white racist cop, at least if his partner is someone of color, they're less likely to do, you know, what's instinctive.
Exactly my point. It gives us an opportunity to educate that racist partner who needs simple education, or who needs to be told this is not the job for you if that's the mentality you have.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to, a couple of things that I wanted to speak on were, and this is based on the problems that I've noticed here in the Twin Cities, because this is where I work, but I'm sure this goes across the board for any state, is gun violence, which has been a huge issue. And I know with the elections coming up, obviously that's going to be part of the debate. Traffic always seems to be hot on social media when it comes to police and what they can and cannot do when they pull you over. And domestic violence is always a huge issue, and I'm a huge advocate against domestic violence, even though that's a touchy subject. So I guess I can start with traffic, simply because a lot of the traffic violations are minor infractions. Most people get pulled over for a simple violation like a taillight or not stopping at a stop sign, having your windows tinted too dark, those minor things. And then I always get asked the question too, if police officers have a quota. We do not have a quota. It is illegal to give a police officer a quota of how many tickets to give a month. And I know it seems like there is one, but there is not. We do get performance reviews. So if we are not performing to the same as our counterparts, obviously then it shows that we're not doing our job, which isn't necessarily true, but that's kind of how that quota thing comes from. Some advice I'd like to give people, the general public, when they're being pulled over by the police officer, is just be respectful. I know sometimes that's easier said than done, because some police officers will be rude to you during a traffic stop for whatever the reason they stopped you for. But I want people to understand that your life sometimes is worth more than picking a fight with a cop who's maybe having a bad day or who isn't a good person. So respect, number one, is very important, and disrespect will cause you either to get a ticket or, for whatever reason, land you in handcuffs or more in trouble than what you would have started with if there was respect to begin with. Whether you agree with the police officer or not. Because, and the reason I say that, if you get a ticket and you believe you don't deserve that ticket, you can always fight for that ticket in court. You have that police officer's badge information. You have their full name, what area they work in. You obviously, you have the right to record any interaction. Obviously, you have the right to record any interaction, but it is important to know that when we pull over an individual, traffic stops are the scariest situations for us. They're probably the most scary after a domestic call, because I don't know what your intentions are as a driver. I don't know what things you have in your car, what your criminal history is, if you have one. I don't know anything. I'm going into this completely blindly, and it's very dangerous. So my alert system is already high when I pull a car over. So if I pull you over, for example, for running a stop sign, and you're completely respectful, "Hi, officer, what did I do?" And I explain to you, "I'm pulling you over for running a stop sign. Can you give me your ID and proof of insurance?" And you tell me and that your insurance is in the glove department, just let me know, "Hey, I'm reaching over to get my insurance in the glove department." Okay, and I'm watching you as you do that. I take your ID and, of course, see your history to know what kind of violations you've had in the past. If this is a common common mistake for you and you're always getting pulled over for the same thing, do you need to have a citation so you can know that this is not something you need to continue on? Things like that. That goes a long way rather than if I pulled you over and automatically you're yelling and the music is on and you're not paying attention or you're being difficult. Like, that makes me worry about why you're making that traffic stop more difficult than it needs to be. Are you hiding something? Is your mind elsewhere? I'm thinking about 10 different million things at once. Plus my radio is going on. I need to know what's going on with my partners that are also on the street. Like, as a police officer, we have 10 different things going on at once. And I might not always be thinking about you and at that moment, even though I probably should be, but the job is just more difficult than what the average citizen thinks. So when it comes to traffic stops, my advice is, number one, respect, and then kind of just have a regular conversation with the cop. Say, be honest. "Hey, I ran that stop sign. I was rushing to work. I'm going to the restroom, or I'm headed to the hospital. I'm in labor," or something. To be able to have that regular conversation with a police officer during a traffic stop, to be honest, goes a long way. Follow through with the process and it goes a lot smoother. So I guess that's my advice for traffic stops. The next scary police call that we take are domestic violence, for obvious reasons. Not only because there is physical violence there, but when you go into someone's home, you don't know what you'll be running into. You don't know what kind of baggage the male or female has, their history when you first come on scene. I mean, obviously that's stuff that you can look into afterwards, but domestic violence is a really sticky situation. And we'll go with, be very stereotypical and say the male was the aggressor in a domestic violence call, that we are called to someone's home, and the female is the one who called. And by the time we get on scene, she recants her story and says she doesn't want to press charges anymore. The first thing we do on a domestic violence call is separate the male and female if they are if they're in the relationship. So, and this is done because women mostly recant their stories. If it's not right there on scene, it'll be the next day or within the same day. In fact, we see cases where the male gets bailed out by the woman who called to report the violence act to her. And this is done for many different psychological reasons that happen between domestic partnerships. But this is very dangerous for us because when we go into someone's home, we don't know what kind of weapons they have, what kind of training this person has, if they've been in the military, if they used to be a police officer, if they have mental issues, what kind of weapons they have in the house. It's very sticky situation for us. So as soon as we get this type of call, number one, we never go alone, or we shouldn't. And again, this is another high alert situation for us. We are constantly aware of our surroundings, and if we need to be more physical than just in a regular call, I guess. And then of course we have to treat the victim in a way where she doesn't feel like we're also victimizing her. When we're asking her questions of what happened, how the assault happened, how long have they been in a relationship, how many times has this happened to her before? And if the male, if we can find physical evidence of an assault to the female party, and this again is assuming that she's the victim, the male automatically goes to jail because we can see those physical marks. And if there aren't any physical marks, it does make it difficult. But if we can have that female say right on scene, yes, he did this to me and I want him to just go away, he will go to jail for the night again. But if she recants her story later on, that does make it difficult to charging-wise, but that's a little further down the road, and that kind of has our hands tied as police officers. So what we do a lot of the time, if the female victim is not willing to cooperate, we kind of just send the two their separate ways and have the male take a break, leave the house for a few hours. Minnesota is a female state, they call it, so we kind of take the sides of the female most of the time and let her stay in the home unless she decides to leave. And the male leaves the home. We say for a few hours, go and take a cool, come back later. And sadly, a lot of the time this is going to be a house or a situation where you'll come back again. Because unfortunately, that's just a cycle of domestic abuse. With psychologically, if she believes that he won't assault her again or abuse her again, she lets him back in after an apology. And it's just a continuous cycle that we have to deal with. And we have to remember as police officers to be sympathetic to the fact that she is a victim every time, that she is hurt every time. And with the stress level we have, we're probably not always as sympathetic as we should be. And we tend to put the blame on the victim for calling police in the first place when she doesn't necessarily ask for their help. So I guess that's kind of like the short of it and our process of how we handle domestic violence. It is a serious issue. And I always encourage people to call 911 or call a helpline. Or if you know someone who is being abused mentally or physically, emotionally, whatever the case is, to reach out to that person constantly, because it, like I said, it's a continuous cycle. It's not something that's going to end just overnight. So those people need support from the people closest to them. And unfortunately, us as police officers, we can only do so much in those situations. We are not social workers, even though we play sometimes the role of social workers when we're in those type of situations. And we aren't attorneys, so we cannot put these men or women who their aggressors in jail for a certain amount of time, especially if the initial report is recanted and taken back. So that's kind of a synopsis of our domestic violence process, I guess.
Mine wasn't really a question. It was more of a thank you, because I had questions about the traffic stop, because, you know, there's the reality and then what you think you have the right to do.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you were, you know, just blunt about that and honest, because I think a lot of people need that, right? We have to acknowledge the system for what it is, and even if it's not right, just to get through that and fight it later on in the court system if you have to. But in terms of the domestic violence, it's still a taboo in our community, right, to talk about it or to kind of raise awareness about it. So from your perspective, what do you think what else can be done either to make, I don't know if it's your job easier, but what, from your perspective, how do you see, what can the community do? Let me leave it at that. If you have like a suggestion for the community. You said for the women, you know, call and kind of be a support system for one another.
Correct.
But as a community, what should we be doing?
We should condone it. I don't think we need to be hiding domestic situations. And I'm sure each of us know of someone who is going through some kind of abuse. And like you said, in our culture, it's such a taboo, and we hide it under the rug. We should not be doing that. It should definitely be faced, and the person who's being abused not only should get the support, but the abuser should know that what they're doing is wrong. Because a lot of time they get away with it because no one talks about it. Even if you don't want to get police involved within your own family, because that's how we solve all of our situations. You bring all the elders and you talk about it, and then people just forget it after that. But it shouldn't be like that. We should continuously let the abusers know what you're doing is wrong. Why do you keep doing it? Do you yourself need some help? Or get that victim away from the abuser. And that sounds easier said than done, because let's say the abuser is your uncle and he's your blood uncle, but you know that the way he's treating his wife is not right. We need to step up in our communities and acknowledge that this is an issue, and it doesn't only affect the, like for instance, the wife, but it'll affect the children. And I work for Metro Transit, it's a little bit different. I don't necessarily go into people's houses, but we probably get more, if I mostly get calls to African households, the cases I see right now mostly are because I can identify with them, or I can speak the same language. So, I mean, when I compare it to the regular, when I compare it to other calls, I don't get that many. I think just because it's still a taboo in our culture to call the police when they need help. But like I said, since I work for Metro Transit and the cases that we get are public transportation. So if someone stole an old lady's cell phone while she's standing at the Cedar station, most likely she probably won't be the one to call, but she'll run into the 24 mall or something, or the Cedar mall, and ask someone else to call for her. And they would send me or one of my other male partners who can speak her language and take the call for her. So we get it sometimes. Usually if it's a little more serious of a call, meaning like it was an assault or sometimes neighbor disputes, but it's a more serious calls. We don't get the minor misdemeanor calls when it comes to our people. I feel like we don't think we can rely on the police. I'm not sure what it is. Or maybe they feel like they won't understand the police officer that comes to them that talks. But I think our community also doesn't understand that they can ask for an Oromo officer and say, hey, I speak Oromo. Can I have an Oromo officer be sent to this call? Or I don't speak Oromo, I speak Somali, or whatever it is. If they're not comfortable with it, they can definitely request a different officer to come. And if they're available, there aren't that many of us in Minnesota or even in the States in general. So it might be harder, or they might have to wait a little bit longer. But they should know that that's definitely an option for them. So I do get it sometimes, but not always.
I have a question. How many Oromo officers are there on the force?
In Minnesota, I believe there are two guys. One works for City Hall, and the other works for Columbia Heights. So those are the only two I know of. Yeah.
Who's in Columbia Heights?
Hashim.
Do you remember? Hashim, okay.
One who's going through our background process at transit. So we'll see how he does with the training.
Okay.
But yeah, compared to how big the Oromo community is in Minnesota, having two is definitely not enough. And especially we don't have one in Minneapolis, which is very surprising. But again, that needs to come from us. We need to push our kids to join those fields to help their people out more.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
even though it's a dangerous job, so I can understand why a mother wouldn't push her kid to do it, but it's needed, for sure.
Yeah. What do you enjoy about the job? What are the fun?
You know, to be honest, I like that every day you're doing something different. It sounds very cliche to say, oh, I like to help people because I might not see that I'm helping somebody every day, but the different type of interactions you meet with people and the chance I get to show them that a police officer doesn't only look like a white male. A police officer can look like anything. I really like talking to people. I feel like when it comes to one-on-one interactions, I can do a better job with that. I just enjoy the job. Even when you take someone to jail and they are drunk or they're high or whatever it is, and at that moment you feel like you're not helping them out. But I've had people who've come to me years later and thanked me for taking them to jail because that was their first step to get into a treatment facility and get the real help that they needed and change their life. So I might have not seen it at that forefront, but even me going to court and saying, testifying for this person and say, yeah, they made that mistake that one day and they fought with me and they stole this candy bar from the store or whatever it was, but they are committed to change their lives. Those little moments are more satisfying, I guess, than what you see on TV and just driving around in a squad car, because it's not how it is all the time. I go to community events all the time. I go to schools and talk to kids. They love that. Especially when you bring a dog with them, they really, really like the police dogs. Like I said, just to see people's face reaction when they see a girl in a hijab in uniform is priceless. I love seeing it.
That's perfect. Thank you. Thank you for being there and representing us all. So we are proud of you, and you know, I think seeing that you put our emotions at ease, and thank you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you. I need help though. So if you guys know any other females who are trying to join, please push them my way, because it's hard to be everywhere all the time. Yeah. The other area I had to discuss was gun or gang violence. And I don't want to sound political with this because I'm trying to stay apolitical or neutral as much as I can. This has been a huge problem in our communities, especially in the Twin Cities. We hear all the time in the news, this teenager died because some other kid shot him over, you know, very simple beef, or somebody said something to someone else on Facebook or social media or whatever it is, and another kid's life was taken because of it. It really hurts, especially to know that it's our own people killing our own people at such a young age. These kids are 13, 6 to 16, 19 years old, and they are playing with guns. There was a case in St. Paul just this past summer, and one of the kids was part of my mentor program when he was in high school, and they were playing with a gun and it went off, him and his friend were, and it killed him. He was in the hospital maybe for a few days, but he ended up dying, and now his friend is in jail for his murder. We take guns so lightly in this country. I don't know how else to express it. And of course there are your constitutional right to have a gun, but we need to know the importance and the responsibility that comes with owning that. Guns are so easily sold and bought on the street from, to be honest, a bunch of different theories of where these guns can be coming from. But as families, I think we need to have honest conversations with our kids when they leave the house about gun violence and the gangs or the type of people their kids are surrounding themselves around, makes a huge impact. Even if your child is not involved in that situation, if he's around people that are involved in it, sometimes that's enough to get them killed. You don't have to necessarily hold the gun yourself. We don't hold it. Guns are just so easily accessible. It's crazy. I personally don't, would not carry a gun if I wasn't a police officer. I don't see the point of it. And I understand there are people who probably have it in their home for self-protection, and that is completely your choice. And I can't take that away from you as a citizen in this country. But people need to know the responsibilities that come with owning a gun in your house, if that's how you're going to do it. That there's a right and wrong way. The wrong way is to have that gun loaded, stored somewhere. It has to be unloaded, and the magazine has to be separate from the gun, and that's what I mean by unloaded. And then it has to be in a safe, locked, and away from where children can access it. And that's assuming that you have a gun in your house. Realistically, us as Africans are probably not going to have that kind of weapon at home. And as far, and when it comes to these kids that are in gangs and stuff like that, we need to have honest conversations in our own household of why our children are being so easily adapted to this type of culture, or to easily influenced by gangs. I mean, even if this, you don't have the label of being a gang, just hanging out with those type of people, why is that so attractive to our kids? And when I say our, I mean like in our community and not like as minorities, and why that hurts us so much. Do we need to be able to have those open conversations? Do we need to have our kids make them busy, like get them into sports and after school programs at a young age so that they're not even interested or they don't even have time to join those gangs? Do we need to go back to that ideology of it takes a village to raise a child? And if we see our sisters or brothers are struggling to raise those kids, do we need to step in and help them instead of saying, oh, that's their family, I'm not going to get involved? You know, do we need to step in and help each other out and say, hey, I see that you're struggling. What do you need me to help with? Do you want me to pick your kids up from school? Do I need to take them to madrasa if you can't wake up in the morning or because you're working and you can't take them? If we need to help each other out in that aspect, or if we need to have a conversation with our kids and say, why don't you want to go to school? Why are you so cranky all the time? We are in the huge taboo is to say like therapy. What has my kid gone through? What kind of things have they seen where they feel like they need to hang out on the streets instead of come talk to me? Because there are a lot of things that go that there are a lot of different factors of why these kids are running to the streets and not the other way around. So the seriousness of how our newer generations are going really concerns me. And we need to have those open conversations within our own families, even if that's not, it doesn't need to be in public is the point I'm making. If you don't want to do that taboo therapy, at least befriend your kids or befriend your neighbor's kids if they feel like they can have those conversations with their families. And going back to what I said earlier about the mentor program, that's one of the reasons why we try to jump in. If we see a kid that is newer on the street and we've never seen them before, I do, and I know a lot of the guys that I'm with, hey, I've never seen you before. Where you come from? Why are you out here? I'm going to drive you home because I know you're going to get in trouble if you keep hanging out with this group of kids. So to intervene before this child gets into serious trouble. And sometimes by the time they get to us as police officers, it's too late. And then it falls on us. Families come to us and say, please don't put my child in jail. But at that moment, my hands are tied and I can only do so much other than offer my advice on different programs or whatever that your child can go through. But this gang and gun violence it hurts me a lot to see our kids go down this negative path, especially with the racist rhetoric we see in the media. It just portrays that we as Black people can't do any better than the violence. We left violence in Africa. That's why we came here, is to live that better life. So why does that keep following us? We need to be a little more self-aware. Does anybody have questions or can I continue?
I have a question.
Sure.
What theories do you have for reasons why Oromo or in general African kids join gangs if it is not something that we are culturally accustomed to?
I really truly believe it's issues that happen at home. In my personal experience from the cases that I've seen, usually it's a single parent household. Excuse me. And the child feels either neglected, like no one's paying attention to them because the single parent is working all the time to try to pay bills. And some kids just need a little more attention than others. So if they're not getting that attention at home, they're going to run and get it somewhere else. Or if there's some kind of grief, they lost a parent or they lost their friend or lost their cousin. Some children don't know how to handle that. And we don't, as Oromo people or even as Africans in general, we don't know how to show affection. We don't know how to say, it's okay, I love you. You don't have to be scared. You know, things like that. We don't know how to, that's just not part of our culture to be super affectionate in that way. And some kids just need that type of interaction or even openness. So if they're not getting the love and support at home, they go outside and find it there. And it might not be exactly what they want, but it's something, and they're not getting it at home. That's generally what I have seen. And I used to think that, oh, these kids are not being punished enough for their actions, and that's why they're not learning their lessons, because there's no consequences to their action. But really, it's maybe because they don't have the level of love. When you have a toddler, and let's say the toddler falls down and hurts themselves, the toddler will go and look at the mom and see, are you paying attention to me? And if the mom makes like a reaction and says, oh, don't cry, then the child starts to cry just to get more of the attention from the mother. That's the same way in the sense, these kids are not being, shown affection. And I don't know if that's, if it's just culturally in general, because back home we didn't see that, but, and these kids are growing up in a different culture than what our parents did back home. It was normal to have tough love and no one showing you and giving you a hug and a kiss, because that was it was everywhere. But here you have kids growing up in a different mentality because of the society they're around. So I feel like us as parents, we need to parent our kids based on how they're living today, because it's completely different than how it was 20, 50 years ago. But again, that's just my personal experience of what I've seen with the cases of kids that come across my desk. The question I get a lot is, or the topic I get to talk to, or people ask me to talk a lot, is about racism in policing and how I can work with white people who probably don't, white people who are any other race of people who don't like people like me. And like I said earlier, the reason we need to have more minorities in the police force is because we force those racist ideologies to disappear. Even if that cop is still going to be a racist, he won't do that in front of me. He's not going to beat up that black teenager because he feels like he can if there's a black officer standing next to him. There is racism all over this country, all over the world. In any culture you see, for some reason, black people just seem to be the target of racism. And policing is no different than that. Whether you're a doctor, there are going to be doctors who are racist and have those ideologies. If you're a computer scientist, if you're in IT or NASA, whatever, and policing is no different. I think the reason policing gets more of the attention is because we have such a huge power to take someone's civil rights away and their freedom in general away. I can take that away from you. I have that authority when I detain you or when I stop you during that traffic stop because you're not free to leave or when I arrest you, which is why I think we get criticized more for that, because we have that such a huge authority and that huge power. So I want people to know that, yes, there is racist cops. Yes, there is racism in policing or in the judicial system in general. But unless we step up to counteract those racist acts and point out the wrongs that our partners are doing, nothing will change. And pointing fingers and blaming others also doesn't change anything. Like I said earlier, me being in this position gives me an opportunity to educate my partners. There are some partners who never had a conversation, or I shouldn't say, who haven't had a personal relationship or even a working relationship with a Muslim before. So they'll ask a question and say, I don't mean to be disrespectful. I don't mean to be rude when I ask you this, but I genuinely don't know. When will those conversations ever happen if we are not in those positions to have those conversations? So we need to step ourselves up and kind of put our pride down a little bit and give people a chance to educate. We need to educate one another. Obviously, we moved to this country and we're forced to assimilate, and we are told you have to know X, Y, and Z. You got to speak English. You got to dress a certain way. You got to talk a certain way, but we don't expect the same thing from them. We need to hold them accountable also and say, this is my culture and this is my religion and this is X, Y, and Z. Just so you know, you're not offending someone else. just to have those open conversations. So I want people to know that the next time they talk to an officer, don't wait for that negative interaction to have a discussion with us. Approach us as if we're sitting around at a holiday gas station, because we all know police officers go to the gas station for a free coffee or whatever it is. Approach us and have a conversation. If you have a question about a ticket, talk to them. If you want to just make a comment or invite us to a community event, that's a perfect time to do that. Even if you don't feel comfortable, I guarantee you they don't feel comfortable, but that kind of puts them on their toes then and let them know that you're at least trying, and then they can reciprocate also. I know Masjid Tawfiq in Minneapolis invites my police department every Ramadan to have a furt together. And that has created such a huge positive communication between the two, because now every Friday they have a police car. I mean, even though there's a police station right across the street from there, they have a police officer who guards their masjid every Friday. I mean, they have a contract with them, so they're being paid for it. But at least now that Oromo community has some kind of connection to that to a police department. And it doesn't matter if that officer is white or black or not, which they're not black. I mean, they're not white, but the point I'm making is that now there's that open line of communication. And that's kind of everything that I had to touch on, unless someone else had a specific topic or question.
I was hoping that you could speak to how women specifically could protect themselves, whether it be like, you know, if you're walking alone late at night, or you're a college student, or, you know, you're a mom and you're targeted simply because you're a woman, right? Yeah. So in what ways, or like, what can we do to protect ourselves? Whether that looks like owning something that we can defend ourselves with, or taking certain classes, like what can we do as a woman to protect ourselves, I guess?
There are a couple of things. As a woman, you have a right to carry anything that you feel need, especially if you live in a neighborhood where you don't feel safe, which to be honest is any neighborhood these days, especially if you're a Muslim woman. Of course, pepper spray is always legal. And I encourage every, to be honest, female student, especially if you're living on campus and you're going home late from work, class or something, to carry a pepper spray 100%. For self-protection, there are techniques to know if someone pulls your hijab, and this is just specific to Muslim girls, or even pull your hair from behind. There are classes, and I cannot name any off the top of my head right now, but I can definitely give it to the Obaleti crew if you guys like, and then
kind of posted along with this forum, but they are defensive tactics geared towards women. And especially since if you're a woman and you're walking home late at night, your majority of the time will be attacked from behind. No one will, you're not going to see it coming from in front of you. So are there different maneuvers and techniques that you can learn to defend yourself when someone does come to you from behind? There are techniques also if you are being choked or taken from the front also. So there are classes, like you asked, for self-defense, like combative techniques to learn. But I do encourage female students also. I mean, I guess any woman could, but specifically female students who are like living on campus to carry pepper spray. Because number one, it's legal. It's not something you can get in trouble for. And even if you are defending yourself, it gives you perfect time to get away. The reason I like pepper spray, I mean, I hate pepper spray, but the reason I like it is because it disorients the attacker. Not only can the person can't see, their smell is taken over by the pepper spray. So it's a perfect maneuver to spray and go. Don't even think about, I guess, different techniques you need to use, because it's so convenient. You spray and you run and leave as far as you can, get to a phone as quickly as you can. If you can remember certain characteristics of the attacker, that really helps, where you were when it happened. If the person was in a car, license plate info is amazing. It helps police officers continue with that investigation. Or even if you don't want to go any further than that, just to protect yourself and you just want to get out of the area, that's why I recommend pepper spray. But again, like I said, there are physical techniques if one wants to learn them. And I can forward that to the Obeleti crew if they want to post that also.
Kadra, I also wanted to add to that, I think the biggest, at least for me personally, I think one of the biggest ways to protect myself is vigilance, you know, just having an awareness of my surroundings.
Definitely.
What do you think about that?
Definitely. And I'm glad you mentioned that. That completely slipped my mind. I tell my high school girls this all the time. And I mainly say it to the younger girls because they're so caught up on their phones when they're taking the train or the bus. And you have, everyone seems to have headphones in and, you know, just doing your own thing. But that opens the opportunity for other people to, I guess, they see an opportunity for them to attack you or use that as a point of weakness. So vigilance absolutely is number one. If you could see it coming before it even comes, then you don't even need to worry about different techniques or the spray, like I mentioned, because then you see it coming. So for example, what I tell my high school girls, if you're on the train and you kind of see an older man or anybody eyeballing you, and you know, you could read body language and you can just kind of feel uncomfortable by the way that person is approaching you or looking at you, I always tell them, go to the bus driver and let them know, because as soon as you speak to someone about it, that person is gets less interested. Then they know that you know they're after you. So I always tell them, approach the bus driver and say, hey, this guy is like creeping me out and I don't feel comfortable. The bus driver normally would say, okay, stand next to me or I'll call the police or whatever the deal is. And of course, if you're on a train and that's not applicable and you're an older woman, if you know that someone is watching you and you feel uncomfortable and you can, like I said, from body language, you can tell that something's going to happen, either call someone on the phone and speak to them out loud so that person knows that you know, again, or so that you can feel more safe, or even a stranger on the train, kind of mention it to them. But the first step, like you said, is vigilance. If you can see it coming before it comes, then you don't need to have a reaction to their action.
Right.
So yeah, that's a good point. Thank you.
What advice do you have for young girls who are interested in pursuing your specific area, being a police or criminal justice? What advice do you have them, and what I guess, approaches should they take? I know you talked about it a little bit, but.
I would say number one, the schooling. I know I mentioned earlier that in Minnesota, the minimum requirement is the 2-year, but always try to get more than the more than what they require you. So for the 2-year degree, forget that. Don't even think about the associate. Go for your 4-year. Have a backup plan in case this doesn't work. You need to have something else that you can fall back on. And that's why I think the education is super important. You don't necessarily need to go to school for criminal justice. You can go to school for anything, political science, or you can be an English major, a psychology major, an art major. It really doesn't matter. Just have something else that you can fall back on if you choose that this is not what you want to do, or for some reason you can't pursue it anymore. So education is number one. Number two, if this is really what you want to do, keep your head up and keep strong, because this job will tear you down multiple times, and there will be people to continuously tear you down. They'll encourage you or discourage you to do the job. So I guess hard work, education and hard work, perseverance, keep pushing on if that's what you want to do. And keep your friends that are outside of law enforcement, because they're invaluable. This job is so negative. You need to have people in the outside world who are less negative, who don't see the negative that you always see. And look for a support system so that when you do go through hard times, you have someone to talk to about it. And reach out to me if you need anything.
Well, thank you so much. You definitely sound like somebody who's very resilient and can overcome a lot of hardship.
Oh, thank you.
So shout out to you for that. You're an amazing woman, and we definitely look up to you, and hopefully there are more women who decide to go down this path, and we will definitely encourage them to reach out to you as well.
Thank you.
And with that, thank you for coming and joining us today. Your presentation was very insightful, useful, and very practical, as a lot of these challenges are just evident, you know, in our society constantly. So we really appreciate you and look forward to hosting you again someday soon. Do you have any last remarks you want to say before we hang up?
I just want to thank you guys so much for giving me this platform to talk about it a little bit. Just the opportunity to reach out to people who I probably otherwise wouldn't have. So shout out to you guys for creating this platform for Oromos all over to be able to connect to each other. So I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. And then for anybody who wasn't able to be here that, you know, might have benefited from your conversation, like I said before, we do put this as a podcast, and you're welcome to share it. And we'll also post the resources that you send us alongside it. It will be on our website or our podcast link, which we will make sure we send to you.
Great.
All right. Well, have a good night, and thank you for those of you who are still listening. Thank you all for joining us and asking questions and participating. This was a great conversation.
Thank you for joining our monthly podcast. If you enjoy our content, or are simply interested in supporting Obolete, please feel free to donate using the donate button on this podcast or heading over to our website at obolete.org or through our Facebook, which has a donate button. There are multiple ways in which you can help us grow and continue to support and serve our community.
In learning more about this topic or are interested in leading a conversation, please contact us on our social media outlets. Our handles are @opolete on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and Snapchat. You can also contact us via our email or our website, which is obolaiti.org. Again, thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you on our next podcast.